All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. This is the Land of Israel Network, and I'm proud to be part of it. My name is Yishai Fleisher, and I am the international spokesman for the Jewish community of Hebron. Hebron is the root of Jewish peoplehood and the initial, essential genome of all biblical faith, because that's where the fathers and the mothers, the heroes of the Bible, are buried. We have an amazing show for you today. We have three parts. We're going to have one part is going to be Torah. We're going to get ready for Shabbat with Spiritual Cafe and Rabbi Mike Foyer. We're going to speak to incredible tourism maker, a tourism opportunity, and that is David Wallace of Eddie's Kosher Travel. He's going to send you around the world, but especially to the Land of Israel for the pilgrimage festivals. And we're going to speak with Muttal Wolf on his show, where I debated him about the right of a soldier to shoot a jihadist terrorist even when he's down. So we have a hot show for you. Let's buckle in, let's get ready, and let's rock. Here we go. All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show here on thelandofisrael.com, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. And I'm back. I'm back in Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh. No more airplanes, no more APAC, no more Washington, D.C., trains, planes, and automobiles. I am back in the homeland. And, of course, if I'm in the homeland, in Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, the holy city of Jerusalem, I'm going to be at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, which is an awesome Torah institution. And the head of that, the educational department of that Torah institution, is Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. It's great to see you, Shai.
And, of course, we are now on Spiritual Cafe, which is the segment of the show that gets us ready for the Shabbat Torah portion. And before we delve into the Torah portion called Shmini, which has a lot of drama in it, Jewish drama, I want to say a few things. First thing is I haven't seen you in a few weeks, Rabbi Mike.
That's true.
It was a little tough to have Purim without you. We didn't get to go through the Megillah, which is just the most, I think, one of the most incredible documents in the history of mankind. And we didn't get a chance to go over that. Chaval, we'll do it next year. But instead, I was out in America, and I did see my own incredible things. I saw things like the APAC conference and 18,500 Jews getting together to love Israel and to talk about the future of Israel. That was awesome. But I also got to be at something ostensibly sad, but also kind of happy, and that is I got to be at a funeral. As I got off that plane, you know that our show, the Spiritual Cafe portion, is sponsored by Jack in honor of his wife Lillian and his sister Sarah.
Yeah, sure.
I was supposed to meet with Jack on Sunday, but instead, and when I get out of the plane and I turn on my phone, it turned out that his wife Lillian's grandfather, who I had met only a few months previous at the age of 103 years old, passed away.
Wow.
Not only that, but Lillian's mom, this man's son, a daughter, this man's daughter, she, Friday night, felt something, and she said, everybody pick up all your food, we're going over to Grandpa's house and to eat with Grandma and Grandpa, and they sat around, and they sang all the songs that he liked, and he when they first came in, his face was like sullen, and, you know, it's like, it's almost being in a different world when you're at that age, as the Pirkei Avot tells us, the Ethics of Our Fathers tells us. But when they started singing, his face lit up, and they sang all of his favorite songs, and then basically he mouthed, "I'm ready," and he passed away that night. No hospitals, no intubations, no diseases, no 1,000 pills, and he just passed away. And when I got out of I had met him only 3 months previous. And I got a chance, and he was very happy to meet me, and he kept saying to people, what a nice man, whatever it is. And I was just like, and when we got out of the plane, we got to be at the funeral. First, it was the kind of speeches, and then we also went to the graveyard. Now, the Syrian custom is not to have a lot of people go to the graveyard, so we actually made the minyan. We actually made the minyan, myself and the director general of Hebron community, the community of Hebron, where I work. We got a chance to be at this this neshama leaving this earth, and I was very touched by that. That's how the trip started. The trip always how it starts is really how it's going to go.
Start with a mitzvah.
Started with a big mitzvah, and as a Jew from Eretz Yisrael, like the earth of Hebron, of Eretz Yisrael, and the forefathers and the mothers coming
to pay last respects. That was an awesome occasion. Then there's another issue that I want to talk with you about, which is the issue that is really stirring up a political hornet's nest here in Israel, and really not just political, but really a sociological, political, national issue, which is the soldier who was filmed shooting a downed terrorist, and how to treat him. The words execution have been floated. Others say that it was completely within his right, within the laws of war, within a period of war. And seeing him also handcuffed, a lot of people are very upset about that. And just yesterday, as I was traveling through the north of this country and meeting with regular folks, including Jews and also non-Jews, Druze. There's Jews and then there's the Druze. Everybody seemed very upset at the treatment of the soldier. And also I've seen some of the comments on the video itself. Haaretz posted the video. Haaretz, which is a kind of post-Zionist type of organization, posted this video, and hundreds of comments supportive of the soldier and angry at our own government for treating him like this. And later on in the show, you're going to hear my debate with Mutzel Wolf that was on his radio show. But I wanted to kind of get your take. I haven't had a chance to see you and talk with you about it. I wanted to get your sense of what we're facing in terms of the jihad terror and how we should deal with it. And the soldier that dealt with it seemingly a few minutes after the threat may have been neutralized, that's still a question mark. Should we be prosecuting him or should we be patting him on the back?
Two things come to mind. One is a deep disgust around the politics. It's not really my field. But I would say that whatever happened there, and I'm unfortunately wise enough to know that just because there's a video that shows something doesn't mean that it's absolutely true. And I have a trust in the military justice system to do its job. But I'm really just disgusted at how there's the politics have preceded any justice here, with this one declaring already that he's guilty and a murderer, the other one declaring already that he's a hero and he's innocent. I think everyone should just be quiet and let the military take care of its own. And I do think that there should be an assumption of support for our soldiers. That's kind of my base. And I also think that if indeed he's found guilty, then he's guilty. On the other hand, the deeper problem here, I would say, is a question in Torah. You know, the Rambam says in the laws of murder that there's someone who's called a rodef, a pursuer, right? And that if someone's pursuing you or another person even to take their life, that I am obligated to stop the would-be murderer. The Rambam says I'm obligated to stop them even to the point of killing them, right? Which is unique because they haven't done anything yet. He says I'm obligated to do that. However, if I can stop them without killing them and I use lethal force, I'm a murderer myself. So there is one perspective to say here that if there was no necessity for lethal force, what the soldier did indeed was murder. There's only one problem with that, is that the laws of Rodef, of the pursuer, are in the what we would call the civil laws of the Rambam. And this is the deep question that our society faces right now. Are we at war or not? Meaning, if a citizen on the street sort of does the confirmed kill, which unfortunately we've also seen, it's a fundamentally different problem than a soldier in uniform who is in a posture of war using lethal force. And the problem I see is that our government has a vested interest in avoiding the fact that we are at war as a society, because it allows them to conduct most of what our lives happen at business as usual, because if it's a social problem, you don't have to win. You don't have to put all of your resources at command and question the fundamental assumptions of your societal posture. If it's a war, well, you only fight wars to win. And that means you have to ask questions about who are we, where are we going, and where are we trying to get to? And those are the exact questions that I see our political leadership unwilling and perhaps even unable to address. And so I would hate to see this young man be a victim to that confusion.
In my mind, it's relatively clear. In the past few months, we've had 40 Jews murdered, and we are there's the call to murder more Jews is a recurring call every single day. If that's not war, then what is? Where we're surrounded by an enemy who calls for our destruction. If that's not what war is, then that's real confusion. If you don't, if you can't say that we're at war, albeit a different kind of war, it's not a war of tanks, and it's a war of civilians. And here I have to also I also have to register one tiny disagreement with you, which is I am a civilian, but in a certain situation, I am turned into a police officer or a soldier. I mean, say in a certain situation, if a soldier or a police officer is not there, I am a trained Israeli defender. And if I have to take out my pistol to defend another person or defend, you know, the society around me or myself, at that moment, I just have a different hat. It's like I'm wearing green at that moment.
Well, that's because armies don't go to war. Societies go to war. And therefore, you, as you said, see us at war. So therefore, you're absolutely right. You're a soldier in that moment. You're not a civilian. My point is, if we were I don't know, in downtown New York, and some guy came up to you and said, you know, give me your wallet, made a lunge with your knife, you shot him in the knee, and he's on the ground writhing in pain, and then he said, well, you know what, this guy shouldn't have gone for my wallet, and then you shot him in the head, that would be murder.
Right. No, we are not in that kind of situation. We're in a societal. Our civilization is being threatened by this jihad, at least in my opinion. And I guess that is indeed the discussion that's happening. All right, and I'm very glad that you brought in some Torah into it, and that opens up our discussion of another Torah story, which also involves death. It involves the judgment of God against Aaron and his sons. This is one of the most painful, if you read it slowly and not just read it kind of fast and kind of as though you're used to it, it's actually quite shocking. And the story basically is that if you remember the book of Exodus, where in the last few chapters, we really started talking about the creation of the tabernacle and painstaking detail, sometimes would be seemingly repetitive detail about the plan to construction, the construction, the erection of it, the whole thing, until it's finally, there it is. And in this week's Torah portion, Shmini, which is around chapter 9 of the book of Leviticus, it's actually starting to work. The actualization of this is actually coming into practice. Here we go. Finally, and we've been waiting for so long, chronologically and thematically, we've been waiting so long. Suddenly, as the practice begins, now the newly anointed Kohanim, priests, ministers, are starting their work, and good things are happening. A fire of God comes down and eats the korbanot, eats the offerings, and Aaron is blessing the people. And how should we say, the clock is ticking. It's ticking, you know, it's like it's set into motion. Everything seems to be going just splendidly. And then suddenly, two of Aaron's sons bring what the Torah describes as a strange fire or uncalled for fire. And it's some kind of offering that they were not commanded to do. And a fire comes down and consumes them. The two sons of Aaron are killed. Their souls are taken away through their nostrils. They're just kind of like snuffed out. And everybody's like, what just happened? And Aaron and Moses have these incredible reactions. First thing, Moses says, well, this is what God had basically told me, that with the close ones, I will be judged. I will be judged by those who are close to me. And I'll be sanctified through the ones that are close to me. And Aaron, in an amazing feat, accepts the judgment, or at least he stands still. He doesn't break down. He doesn't reject God. He just holds still. He just holds it together. And then we'll learn about how it goes on. But let's just stop here and talk about this super dramatic moment where things were going so darn right, and they went so wrong, where God takes out these two sons of Aaron, and Aaron is kind of asked to continue with the loss of his sons right before his eyes.
Well, it's deeply ambiguous whether it went wrong. I know we place such a high value on human life that we immediately see a story like this and we focus on its tragic element. It's two lives were lost, which is admirable. But Moshe's response opens up for us a perspective on the loss of their life, which is completely different. He says, "Bikrovai ekadesh," right? As you said, with those who are close to me, I will be sanctified. And, you know, I want to speak later a little bit more about that word, kadosh, holy, because it has a core meaning, which I'm going to leave untranslated, which speaks deeply to what happened here, that somehow there was a final stage of intimacy for God's presence to be fully in the world, which was consuming. It was consuming. And the real question lies in the line you pointed to, which is that they offered Esh Zara Asher Lo Tziva Otam. They offered a strange fire, which God had not commanded. Meaning, why does it have to tell me it was a strange fire, which God had not commanded? Shouldn't it be by definition, if it's a strange fire, it was other than what God commanded? There's no redundancy here. That somehow what it was that happened was beyond their natural state. Right? Because don't forget that Zara also summons up the idea of Avodah Zara, what we call strange worship, right? The worship of other gods.
Idolatry.
Idolatry. But the key is that there's Avodat Hashem, there's a service of God, and there's Avodah Zara, right? There's strange worship. And even though we translate it as idolatry, it's important to remember they share a root, Avodah, its service. In the same way, this Esh, this fire, which on one hand is what we use to offer the sacrifices to the incense, right? And in a minute will actually be used to execute God's judgment, right? That Esh is natural to them. The question is, what's the Zarut? What's the strangeness which was not commanded in this moment?
Well, some of our rabbis, our sages say that they came in maybe inebriated, because immediately after this chapter is the laws against coming in to serve in the temple inebriated. But what rings more solidly with me, in any case, is that later in the Torah, Rashi, in already in the book of Deuteronomy, at the end of the Torah, will say, look, this happened as a boomerang, as a karma for the act of supporting the Jewish people's effort in the golden calf.
Mm-hmm.
In the golden calf, Aaron plays a significant role. Yes, he's trying to stop it, but he kind of also allows it to happen, and he kind of plays a certain role in allowing the Jewish people. And the Torah says about him that he allowed them to go wild.
Yes,
and what Rashi's going to say later on, it works for me, which is he's going to say, look, you let my children go wild. I let your children. God says, I let your children go wild. You know, Jews died in a plague that came subsequent to the golden calf, so to your children die. You have to feel the pain. You have to feel the pain. By the way, Moses' son almost gets killed. If we remember, Gershon gets almost swallowed up by a snake or killed by a snake.
Sure.
And Miriam's son, Hur, gets killed by the Jews, and Aaron's two sons get killed in this fire. Meaning to say, when you're close to God, you're dealing with these things, it's dangerous, but B, it's like you've got to know the pain of my children. And the way you have to understand how God says, you have to understand how I see the world. And my children are lost. You've got to know that you got to feel it on your own flesh.
That is definitely the moral plane. I think there's a deeper existential plane in which this is happening. Because, you know, after all the details that you listed, right, the speaking out of the structure of the Mishkan and the repetition and its construction and everything that you said, one might actually think that this is a technical system. Right? Like, now all we do is got to switch the flip or flip the switch and offer the fats, and there we go. Presence of God. Boom. Right? But the reality is that God is a living flame. And flame, by definition, is consuming. It's not bounded. Right? And in order to know how it is to live with God, there has to be that pushing of the boundary and the falling back. Right? We saw this on Purim. Why is it on Purim? Purim is such a holiday of ecstatic celebration. Why can't we just get a little bit drunk and have a nice time and smile and tell a little story? No, you're supposed to get to the point where you don't know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordecai. Because you have to cross that boundary to understand where it is. And it's true, you don't live there. We don't live in an unbounded world. The Mishkan is very bounded. But nevertheless, imagine how cold the service in the temple and in the tabernacle would have been if they had never actually touched the wall to burn themselves. And I believe that's what Moshe is saying to Aaron. Moshe says, listen, Aaron, I got news for you. I knew all along that the only way to really get a fire started is to make some sparks. And even though once you get it started, you can feed it gently and keep it, but there has to be that moment of ignition. I just thought it would be me or you. And I was ready for that. But I see now that somehow your children were even holier. And I believe that's why Aaron could hold it. Not just on the moral plane you're speaking about, that he accepted God's judgment. I think he understood that in many ways, this was the fulfillment. And to that, I have to add something which is a little uncomfortable to the Western humanist, even in me, but out there, is we have to remember that even in the Torah, life is not the highest value. And we live in a world which nobly, in many respects, has placed human life as the highest value. But the Torah says, no, the highest value is the will of God. And it's true that the will of God in, let's say, 99% of the time is that human life be sacrosanct. But it's also true that there's another 1%. And if you see where that 1% lies, that 1% lies in all the places that allow the fire of truth to really burn in the world.
So, you know, we're now that you started talking through this, I started seeing that there's really a theme to today's show, which is life and death. The first one I talked about, the grandpa who passed away in Brooklyn. The second one is the death of Aaron's two sons. And the third one that we're going to go to and we're going to keep going is actually animals, eating animals, the killing of animals for eating. And the reason I'm making this what seems to be a jerky a transition, and that is because the Torah itself will take it to a different place, this Torah portion, and talk about the kosherness of certain animals or the non-kosherness of other animals, meaning to say the ability of Jewish people who follow the law to eat or not eat certain things. So I want to tell you famously in our family, my mom, who started her scientific career as a oceanographic scientist, meaning to say she studied the seas, and she was not religious at the time at all, nor was she aware of these laws, she stopped eating shellfish. She just stopped eating them after studying them, meaning to say she's like, no, you're not supposed to eat this stuff.
They're the filters of the sea.
Right, they're the filters of the sea. It's garbage, it might taste good, but it's really not good for you. That's not what you're supposed to eat. And that was just a simple scientific conclusion that she came to. And science may or may not back up certain decisions that the Torah makes, but the Torah is going to limit us, and it's going to give us signs and certain things. For birds, it's not really signs, but it's actually a litany list of which birds can you eat, which birds can you not eat. With fish, two specific signs. Insects, very few that are, you know, that you can eat. Most insects you cannot eat. With mammals, meaning to say, what do we call these things? Animals that we know, like
cows, sheep, goats,
right? Or pigs. The Torah is going to lay out a system by which you'll know it's got to have a split hoof and it's got to chew its cud. These are weird things. I'm supposed to eat something that has split hooves and chews its cud, but if it's got like split hooves like a pig, but it doesn't chew its cud, that's not kosher. What's that all about? What is that all about? And there's two ways to look at it. One way to look at it, there's many ways to look at it, but two obvious ones is like, this is just weird stuff, some kind of anachronistic thing. Or you say, and you've heard, used to be that you would hear from like Reform Jews, especially you would hear things like pig is not kosher because of certain diseases that were prevalent at the time. They didn't know how to refrigerate and so on and so forth. The other one is like, here is a secret knowledge that God is imparting to us through this book about what's good for us and not good for us, or what will keep us separated or not keep us separated. This is a secret knowledge that's now being given. It's like, psst, come over here. I got to tell you a secret. Here's the animals you don't want to eat. Here's the ones you do want to eat. Here's the fish. Here's the birds. I'm telling you now as a secret, this is going to be good for you. This is good for you. This is good for me. It's good for us. It's good for the world. And it's like, when you read these kind of Torah portions, you're like, are you talking to me, God? Are you telling me things that like nobody else knows? It's an amazing revelation about how to maneuver this world.
Yeah, it's a recipe for navigating life whose end goal in my mind is, again, Kedusha, holiness. And as we were speaking before the show, you brought up that sort of eternal question around kashrut, around the dietary laws, of is there purpose to keep us separate from the nations of the world, or is that just a consequence? Right, there are many laws. It's very clear their purpose is not to keep us separate, but it's a consequence. But here in kashrut, it seems to be that once you start eating different things, and then in the extension of that, using separate vessels for your cooking and separate processes for how you mix things, etc., you are become inevitably separate.
I just went to Drew's house yesterday, and I just couldn't eat anything that was being offered to me.
Yep.
And they respected that, but they respected it to the point that, okay, I respect your religion, but it's not like fun. There's something...
It's awkward.
It's awkward.
There's a barrier.
Right. It's a barrier. It's like, you and I, I can't eat in your house.
I'll say it differently. You and I are not the same. That's what it comes down to, right? And there's a deep distaste for that assertion, especially in Western culture. What do you mean we're not the same? Because not the same must mean better or worse. We don't even want to go there right now. Just not the same. And I've seen recently a deep misunderstanding of what holiness is. I asked my students recently, what does the word kadosh mean? So they all say holy. I say, great, what's that mean? And most of them get confused because they've never really thought about it. And some say it means separate, which is actually a reasonable definition, which is rooted in the Middle Ages. But I'm very wary of the Middle Ages in general. Why? Because separateness is not the essence of what holiness is. It's its consequence. What do I mean? The essential definition of holiness is devotion. Right? I can prove it to you very easily. If you devote something to the Holy Temple, you should see it built soon in our day. What do you call it?
Hekdesh.
It becomes hekdesh. It's devoted property.
Right.
Now, because it's hekdesh, it has what's called din me'ila. It's forbidden to use it for any other purpose. It's separate from all usages.
Right.
But it's not defined by its separateness. It's defined by its devotion. And an expression of its devotion is separateness. Also, what do we call marriage?
Kiddushin.
Kiddushin, right? And that's because when you became devoted to your wife and she devoted to you, you became separate from every other person. The separateness is not what defines you. The devotion defines you, and the separateness is an expression of it. In the same way, kashrut, the laws of the dietary laws, are about holiness. That's why, by the way, the Rambam, when in his great compilation of the Mishnah Torah, right, when he puts the laws of kashrut in, he puts them together with the laws of sexual relationships in a book he calls Sefer Kedusha, a book of holiness. And you'd say to yourself, wait, what do sexual laws and dietary laws have in common? The answer is they're about devotion. They're about devotion, which expresses itself in being separate. And that is, in my mind, what this entire Torah portion is about.
And it's also about, those things are often related. Let's say you're trying to give a lesson about keeping your eyes averted from something that you're not supposed to look at, and you're talking to young people, so you'll often say, and you see a Twinkie in the store, or you see a sandwich that you're not supposed to eat, and we can use food as something that is akin to sexual things, because it's like it's something that you want, it's something that gives you a pleasure, and it's something exactly that at those points where you have to separate yourself off and not be devoted to those things in order to be devoted to a thing above.
And you know why? Because what's underlying them both is desire. And that's very important to understand is that holiness, in its definition as devotion, is about taking that deep human desire for intimacy and connection and directing it to God. Right? And that's the idea. This is why the world is so confused today, because we have so twisted and manipulated our processes of desire and devoted them to all kinds of things other than God, that we don't even understand what healthy desire is any longer. And then religion masquerades as the suppression of desire, which is, I think, the greatest tragedy of all.
So kosher is our ability to take something that we desire in this world. Dietary laws will help us keep ourselves, how should I say, from going over the edge. Keep us plugged into him.
Keep us devoted.
But I also think that it's such a gift to be given this knowledge. That's what amazes me.
Yeah, sure.
It's like, look, I created the world, and I'm telling you that I don't want you to eat this. I don't know if he doesn't want us to eat this because it's not good for us, or because by not eating it, we stay devoted to him. All of the above, maybe. You know, all answers are right. But it's an amazing thing that Torah is going to be like, it's going to lay it out. And it's like, I am the artist. I'm now going to tell you, you know the fish that you keep on, you know, I watch shows about fish with my kids, and it's like they're always finding new, like, they're like, this woebegone shark has never been seen before. What a, you know, it's like, I made all these things, really, and you know, I want you to eat only things that have scales and fins. It's like I personally have this belief that the wackier it is, the more awesome it is, like the more holy it is. It's like, what? Oh, wow, you're revealing to me this knowledge? Or tefillin. I love seeing Jews with tefillin on their head with phylacteries, quote unquote. By the way, that's not a good word. I looked it up. Phylactery is not a good word. It means like an amulet charm. Forget it. But you see Jews with these leather boxes on their head. You're like, that is so weird. That is so cool. That is so cool. Thank you for that knowledge. I'm going to take a little break now for a second. Birshutcha, Rabbi Mike Foyer on Spiritual Cafe. I want to tell you about two couples that I met. They're actually not couples, but they're all in couples in names. What I mean is I met two Andrews on the trip, who are listeners to the show and friends of what we're trying to do in Israel and Hebron and connecting the Jewish people, in Jerusalem, of course, here at Beit Midrash Olam Yaakov, connecting the Jewish people to the Jewish story, Andrew H. and Andrew W. They are two amazing people that I met on this trip. And I also want to thank two Aarons. One Aaron is Aaron F., and he has donated at thelandofisrael.com a monthly donation, and that makes this show and the other shows at thelandofisrael.com possible. Thank you very much, Andrew and Aaron, the two Andrews, and now we're up to Aaron's, right? And so thank you very much, Aaron F., and his mom, who is a big listener to all these shows. Aaron W., on the other hand, is a man who sent me a very, very, very powerful and very personal email about many of his personal struggles, including the loss of his fiancée to cancer, and a lot of painful things. And all I want to say is that it's a great honor for me to be in touch with him and help him through these struggles. Maybe if I get his permission, I will send you, Rabbi Mike Foyer, some of the this correspondence so that you can help Aaron live the incredible life that gift of life that he has. He's an incredibly talented and beautiful and smart person, but he's been he's had a deck of cards that has not been easy at all. But we love you, Aaron, and thank you so much for being, just thinking that we could be part of your life. That's amazing. Thank you very much. Finally, before we get back to the Torah portion, I want to also thank the good people at Hebron. Hebron.com is the website. Hebron is a Jewish community south of Jerusalem, the sister of Jerusalem. It is where the fathers and mothers of the Jewish people are buried. It's where King David started his kingdom. It's where Caleb came to pray when the Jewish people were coming back to the land of Israel. It is an incredible place, very challenged, surrounded by jihad and other negative forces. Come and strengthen it. Please be part of the story. That's where I work. I'm the international spokesman there. And when you're coming to the land of Israel, and of course you're coming to Yerushalayim to meet God, come meet the founders of the Jewish people and the brave people who are defending those founders today. And this Torah portion so far, let's get back to it. We talked about Grandpa in Brooklyn. We talked about Aaron's sons. You gave a very interesting and I think alternative approach to that does exist, of course, in the sources of how high Aaron's sons were and how they were kind of the catalyst or the, you know, the match head to start the process of igniting the process of the work in the temple, that kind of starter moment, the starter fire. Then we went to the kosher, the laws of kashrut, and all those really was life and death. The kosher is, and all the sacrifices are also in the sense in lieu of our own personal death. When you give an offering in the temple, you're supposed to look at that offering and say, the truth is, I deserve to be offered up on this for my sins and for other reasons. I don't even, you know, this is a gift of life that I have. I've may have screwed it up. I'm offering this thing instead of my life. And when you offer up an offering, you're supposed to push down on its head with all of your strength, and you're supposed to confess your sins. And then that thing like takes your energy and takes your sins, kavyachol, you know, ostensibly, and then is offered up. Finally, in this specific week's Torah reading, we are going to read also from Parshat Para, the red heifer. The law is having to do with the red heifer. And this is all in preparation of the upcoming holiday of Passover. How is the red heifer connected to Passover?
So the red heifer is a process by which we gain purification. Right? It's not the time or place to go through all the details of why that is. But it's a process of taking this cow and the hyssop and the cedar and the scarlet and burning them together down to their ashes. And then these ashes are used to remove the impurity of death in particular. And in order to get to Passover, which is the wedding night, so to speak, between, you know, God and the Jewish people, or at least the engagement, we could go through that whole discussion, but it's certainly a moment of tremendous intimacy and devotion and holiness, right? Purity is the gateway to holiness because it's what removes barriers to relationship. If you think about how ritual purity is used in Jewish law today, that's exactly what it does, right? When a man and a woman have a period of separation, woman goes to the mikveh, to the ritual bath, and they return to intimacy. Right? If a person wants to go up onto the Temple Mount in order to get a little bit closer to God, they have to do it in a state of purity. They go to the mikveh. If a non-Jew decides to come within the boundaries of Am Yisrael and join in a more intimate relationship with Israel and therefore with God, part of what they do is they go to the mikveh, right? Because purity is the gateway to holiness in that definition of holiness of devotion and intimacy. And here's the kicker. As we spoke about kashrut as difficult to understand, in fact, I would agree with you that, in fact, I don't think it's meant to be understood. It's meant to be lived. And you can contemplate it or not. It's meant to be lived. And that's because it is a particular type of law in the Torah, which is called a chok. Right? A chok is a law which our sages teach us whose reason cannot be understood.
It's not that it doesn't have a reason, or it has a super reason, or whatever. The bottom line is we, in our limited capacities, will not get to the bottom of it. We won't own it. We will not own it. He owns it.
And the red heifer is the quintessential chok. I mean, who can understand why a red cow, some cedar, a hyssop, you know, et cetera, would produce purity? Furthermore, of course, not only does it produce purity, but you know the person who burns it becomes impure? And if the priest uses it to purify someone else, he himself becomes impure?
You know, that aspect of the red heifer never seemed that mysterious to me, that specific aspect.
Uh-huh.
Certainly what you said at first, which is how is this thing even working? Sure, that will never be known. But it doesn't strike me as so odd that the person who's closest to something and touches it in its most concentrated form gets kind of a reverse effect. I can give you many, many examples of that. The fireman who's going in to rescue people from a fire or put out a fire, he's the one who gets burnt. Right?
Yes.
You have to say the closer you are to a concentrated form of something, it may have a different effect on you, the opposite effect. It's like a fireman, you would think that because he's so gifted at fighting fires, he's the one who's definitely not gonna get burnt. No. It's you get too close to something, you get, you know, a fire, if you stand next to it, it keeps you warm. You walk into it, it's gonna burn you.
So in touching source, you touch that paradox that a thing can be a source of purity and impurity. Because
what about
only
what about a
source.
Person who's close to God, like Moses? He's very, very close to God. That means he's very, very holy. But there's one layer more, and then he's gone. He's going to be killed for seeing God too closely.
So you're touching on what I'm driving at, is that there's a place in which paradox, which we often think means contradiction, is actually just teaching us that everything has one source, right? And that's the beauty of these chukim, and it's so hard to grasp the idea that opposites come from the same source, that it has to be taught in a chok. You know what a chok is very closely related to the word chakak, to engrave. And you know what the fundamental difference between engraving and writing is? Writing, I communicate information by taking one substance, ink, and putting it on top of another. Paper, here you go. Now you can learn. For engraving, I can put information into something by taking something away. Right? It's that, like on Purim, that acceptance that I can't really know how two opposites coexist and they have one source, but I can accept it. I can act on it. And that itself is also a preparation for Pesach. It is a specific type of purity, of accepting the fact that there's only one source. Were you telling me God split the Red Sea, 10 plagues? And yes, I'm telling you that. But all the historians in the okay, that's fine. I'm still telling you that. Are you saying this is true? Absolutely. How do you know? Well, here's the story. And that is why what we're after on Pesach is the purity of Emunah and the holiness and devotion to God, which it brings. And this is an essential step in the preparation for it.
All right. So we are starting indeed to get prepared for Pesach. This week we're going to be reading about the red heifer. And we're already... Purim is this bright star that kind of explodes on the scene, but then dims very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it's like the minute Purim's over, it's like reset, Etch-a-Sketch, shaky moment, and it's time to go to Passover. It's time to get right into it. We're already less than 30 days before the holiday, and we're getting ready for it. So in the next few episodes of Spiritual Cafe, with the help of God, we will be concentrating getting ready for certainly the Torah portion, but also for the holiday of Passover, which has laws and the text of Passover. So much to learn and so much excitement coming. It is a pilgrimage holiday. Ladies and gentlemen, you are invited to Jerusalem to take part in this pilgrimage holiday. It is coming up. If you didn't buy your tickets yet, do it now, because God is calling us to Yerushalayim. We're here in the heart of Yerushalayim in Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov. The website is sulamyaakov.com. Great audio tracks, maybe some videos, lots of lessons. You can continue your learning there. Certainly more great radio at thelandofisrael.com. I'd like to hear from you, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, or at Twitter, Yishai Fleischer, at Facebook, Yishai Fleischer, LinkedIn, YouTube, I don't know what else. I don't have Snapchat. Don't try me there. But the bottom line is that there's a way to connect, but the most important thing is that you're connected to the story of Israel, to the God of Israel, to the Torah of Israel, and to Jewish strength, which is being reborn in our time. Rabbi Mike Foyer, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. It's great to see you back.
And I forgot, of course, Hebron.com. Stay tuned. More great stuff's on the way. And shalom. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that Torah with Rabbi Mike Foyer on Spiritual Cafe. Right now, I am sitting right across from the Temple Mount in my studios here on the Mount of Olives. And let's get to the next segment, which is how do we bring all of you to Jerusalem on an amazing kosher tour? All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Right now, I am in beautiful Neve Ilan, one of my favorite places in the land of Israel, somewhere between a little bit outside of Jerusalem, overlooking Tel Aviv, and it's forested, and it's beautiful, and it just gives you a sense this is the land of Israel. And the reason I'm here is because I'm in preparation for a little bit less than a month from now, Passover, Pesach. I'm going to be at this hotel as the scholar in residence and the host for an amazing vacation for those people who choose to come to the land of Israel or even from the land of Israel and just want to get away from their house. But people who want to be close to Jerusalem, in the land, vacationing here, they want to hear some good speeches, they want to be close to Jerusalem. And in fact, this hotel at Neve Ilan is part of a much larger conglomerate of hotels that are part of something that's happening through Eddie's Kosher Travel. I don't know if you've heard of it, but you're probably a traveler who's interested in traveling, but you want to do it kosher style, and you should check out koshertravelers.com. And through this Eddie's Kosher Travel, koshertravelers.com, is where I'm actually working over your potential Pesach vacation. The CEO of Eddie's Kosher Travel is David Wallace. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Yishai.
Okay, so we're very excited to hang out with you and the folks that are coming in. There's almost 100 people coming in right now to Neve Ilan.
That's correct. That's just the first 2 days, and then Chol HaMoed, we have another wave of families coming. So the peak will be about 80 families, which adds up to about 200 plus, including kids, adds up.
It does add a nice crowd. But that's just in one hotel. Tell me about the other hotels that you're running.
Sure. This is one of five hotels that we have in Israel. Look, the main thing is that we bring people home. That's the main thing. Where, the Chag HaPesach is traditionally should be celebrated in our homeland. So whereas throughout the year we run different tours all over the world and cruises, comes Pesach and Sukkot, the times of year when Shalosh Regalim, we encourage people to come home. So we have five hotels in Israel for Pesach. This one, Neve Ilan, as you mentioned. We have the sister hotel of Neve Ilan, which is called the Hacienda up in Ma'alot. We have the Nofki Nosar. The Ma'alot is in the Galil. We have Nofki Nosar on the Kinneret. We have Ramada Suites Hotel in Netanya on the Mediterranean. We have this one, Neve Ilan, in the Judean Hills. And then we have Ramat Rachel out of Jerusalem, south of Jerusalem. So that way there's something for everybody on the water, in the mountains, in the city area, something to choose from. And we have quite a number of families who are sort of breaking it up. 4 days here, 4 days there. Get people to really enjoy what Israel has to offer over the days of Chol HaMoed.
That's a lot of fun. Last year when I was at this hotel, I got to see some amazing things. I got to see grandparents that brought in their dispersed global families, you know, a little bit from London, a little bit from South Africa, a little bit from New York, a little bit from Jerusalem, and they all conglomerated together in one hotel lobby. And it was just a, it was a kibbutz galiot. It was an in-gathering of exiles, in-gathering of families here at these hotels. That happens often,
Happens often, and for us, it's probably the most satisfying part of this type of work. My wife and I and my whole team, bringing families together, seeing them enjoy their time together. You know, today's fast-paced world, everybody's running, people living global village all over the place. By bringing families together, they have an opportunity, especially on a time like Pesach, when you're passing down the tradition, from one, the grandparents, they tell their stories to their children, the grandchildren. It's a phenomenal event to watch, and you see that unfold in front of your eyes. It's amazing.
In fact, there's one family that's coming here that's going to have some 40 people, is that right?
Yeah, and that's an average. That we've got families of 15, 20, up to 40. Listen, for the grandparents, sometimes it's their only time they'll see their family all together, one time a year.
It's amazing that we have that ability. Throughout the year, though, you run different kinds of tours also globally, and they're all kosher. That means that you can...
All kosher.
You're going to get a some Jewish content. You're going to get kosher food, certainly, and you're going to get to pray in the Jewish quorum fashion.
Yep.
So you can go everywhere. But one that I'm interested in is a whiskey tour. Is that right? You can go to Scotland and find out the...
This is my pet favorite, Yishai. Will you join us? 15th of May. We have 20 people joining, okay, from people as far as Zurich, New York, some from Israel, from the Anglo towns, and these are the even some couples, not just the guys who have their Kiddush club,
right.
On a five-day tour of the Highlands of Scotland. We're going to six distilleries. We're eating kosher food every night. What I do is we try and tap into the local community, so we get a feel of the Jewish heritage in that community. In Edinburgh, we're going to the oldest shul. In Glasgow, we're going to the oldest shul there. We're going to tap into Chabad. We eat at the kosher restaurant, and that's a five-day package there in May.
How does that happen? Where do you fly to?
Fly to Glasgow.
You fly to Glasgow. So Glasgow. People are flying from all over.
York. Meet in Glasgow on the first day of the tour on the Sunday morning.
And it's a bus tour?
Yeah. Basically, we're on a bus. We're based at one hotel for the whole week. And every morning, 9 o'clock in the lobby, out we go for the day.
Wow.
Except for the one day in the middle where we go up to the Highlands, the three-hour drive, where we've got to cover three distilleries in one day.
Three distilleries in one day?
Including the Rolls-Royce McCallum.
Okay, but the only problem is how do you remember it afterwards? That's definitely a problem. Well, you got to take pictures or have a designated rememberer.
Exactly. The driver's busy driving.
That's an amazing tour. That is some. I'll definitely consider it. I'm not sure. I'm a little bit busy right now, but that does. There's a picture of the Glen Livid here.
That's it.
And it's the ultimate Scottish whiskey tour, the 15th through 19th of May, 2016. And I'm sure that space is limited.
Four places left, $19.50 per person, plus your flights.
Wow. Okay, that's a good deal. And of course, first and foremost, we're inviting you here to the land of Israel to enjoy the pilgrimage festival. And you also do Sukkot as well. I want people to start thinking about Sukkot.
Shavuot too.
Shavuot as well.
Yes, Shalosh Regalim. Especially this year, Shavuot is over two nights. Mm-hmm. Because you have, you've got the Friday night and Shabbat.
Friday
Saturday
Shabbat.
Night. Saturday night is Shavuot night. So Erev Chag is Friday. So you have Saturday nights. It goes over two nights.
Wow. Okay. So people are coming in. And I've also taken part a little bit in some of the Sukkot stuff. That's beautiful stuff.
Yep.
In Caesarea and Caesarea. Yep. So people can come in. I think that's an amazing opportunity. You're going to have a great vacation. You're going to come to the Holy Land. You're going to connect with people like yourself. And you could do it all at koshertravelers.com. David, sounds like great times.
Yishai, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. And we hope your listeners will join us.
Absolutely. And of course, I hope they join me here at Neve Ilan. That's definitely one of the packages offered, and you can take advantage of it. How much is that going to be around, you think?
For a package in Neve Ilan, it's around 5,000 shekel for a couple, for a couple of nights. I mean, depends how long, how many days they stay for, how many kids, what type of room.
That's
all
right.
That sort of thing.
Okay.
But the beauty is all the day tours. Every day there'll be day tours. We go to the Channel 2. We're going to the Diamond District. We're going to Park Britannica. There's a lot on, especially out in Neve Ilan, because like you said before, we're very central to Jerusalem.
All right, David Wallace, thank you so much for that opportunity. And I'm going to be here, and you're going to be here. If physically, it's possible. If not physically, then spiritually. If not on this in this Pesach, then maybe on Sukkot. And if not in Israel, then go to Scotland.
I say one last thing. We say every year at the end of the Seder, L'shana Abba B'Yerushalayim. Well, here we are. We're offering it to you all. We're in Jerusalem.
L'shana Hazot B'Yerushalayim. Exactly. KosherTravelers.com. David, thanks so much.
Thanks, Yishai. Take care.
All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed my talk with David Wallace. Now let's talk with Muttal Wolf, show host here in Israel, Reb Muttal, who oftentimes is on a different part of the aisle, different side of the aisle when it comes to certain issues. And here we're debating on his show the issue of whether it's okay to shoot a terrorist, a jihadist who came to murder Jews, even if he's already down.
My dear friend, Yishai Fleischer, is the spokesman for Hebron. Yishai, I figured instead of fighting about this all morning on Twitter, we should jump on the air and do a little of this here. Here's my question, okay? You and I agree that it's good this guy is dead. It's good that he's not in the world. It's good that this human piece of filth's life ended in a pool of blood with a bullet in his head. My question to you is, was it legal? And if it's not legal, shouldn't there be some sort of consequence for this guy?
First thing, before you tell me what, you know, on air, what you and I agree or don't agree with, let me use my own words. And I don't like your formulation.
Okay.
And I don't want to use those words at all. I want to make it much clearer.
We're turning hostile already.
It's because I want to use my own words to describe what I understand and not your
words.
Go
ahead.
Okay, I don't use the words human filth. I don't use that language. I use this language of clear enemy that came in and came to murder Jews. He's a jihadist within a jihadist ideology, came to kill a Jewish soldier, and he ended up dead. Meaning to say he came to commit a crime of murder, and he himself lost his life. Now, with regarding to the soldier and how he acted, the fact is that there's going to be a review process, and we'll see what actual findings will show. I completely reject this idea of being prejudged. It's an undemocratic idea. It's simply not...
We're not the court. We're the media. We're not judging. We're commenting.
I'm commenting
on that. There is a video that's gone viral. How do we not comment on it?
I'm talking about the media, and I'm talking about our own government. And I think that our government has acted quite shamefully in that they have rushed to condemn a soldier who's on the front line facing jihad. And he may have sensed the danger. He may not have sensed the danger. There is some speculation that he sensed danger. The video may look a different way. I'm not sure, really. The bottom line is I think it's really quite simple. You have a soldier on the front line. He dealt with a terrorist. The terrorist may have been downed. He shot him. Now, after that, it's a discussion within the army. Did he act properly? Did he not act properly? But it's certainly not a world conversation. This whole ethos of moral army, as though we're so moral and our army's so moral. The most important thing to remember here is that the army serves a purpose. The purpose is to defend the Jewish people and to defend Israel. This jihadist wanted to destroy Jews and wanted to destroy Israel. He was neutralized, okay? And he was neutralized in a way of finality. That discussion about how it's done and if it's done correctly, okay, it's a discussion that can be had. You know,
it's a discussion that has been had.
That's right,
and the decision has been once a terrorist is neutralized, they are now a prisoner.
You have been saying that on Twitter over and over again, and you've told me also on Twitter that the Prime Minister has made comments to that effect. The fact is,
Prime Minister, Defense Minister Moshe Alon,
right.
And by the way, the IDF has come out and said that this was not a legal shooting.
Fine. Legal or not, the question of morality and legality are not the same thing, first thing.
Agreed.
they can't come out because there hasn't been an investigation. Let's just be clear again. I can't make this any clearer. An investigation happens before, you cannot judge it beforehand. So the IDF cannot come out and say that it's illegal. Somebody in
the IDF has leaked, they have intentionally leaked evidence that they have because they did file criminal charges against him in the military court in Jaffa, and they released evidence that they have, as they tend to do, to show, hey, we actually have a case here.
That's totally fine. The fact is that the case has not been decided. And they have evidence. I saw the video, I'll tell you the truth. I'm not sure he did the perfectly rightest thing. I'm not sure he did that. And I heard the same thing that Victor Lieberman said. He said, I'm not sure he acted exactly properly, but maybe he acted even illegally. But did he act immorally? I'm not sure. I'm not really not sure. I don't see what the morality issue. Here was a terrorist who came to kill. He was already downed, and he was shot, you know, in action while he was trying to kill, and he took another shot. I'm not so sure that there was any issue of morality here. I don't think he was a prisoner. P.S. I think he was.
We're talking about two different moral issues here, Yishai.
5 minutes as well. I have seen terrorists shot less acting with yet more vigor, and then died subsequently. I'm pretty sure that he was going to be dead in a few minutes. I really don't think it's a question of morality so much.
We're talking about two different issues of morality. Here's the issue of morality Here's the issue of morality that I'm interested in is, can soldiers decide these things on the spot? It's not I don't care if he killed this guy or not. I don't care that this guy is dead. What I care about is that we have an army, that there is a chain of command that does operate under rule of law,
you're speaking like a real person who's never been in the army. And the fact is that you don't understand what it means to be on the front line with a killer right at your throat.
I'm not saying I don't understand
him. And the bottom line, and that language that you're using, which is, you know, a language of, you know, a kind of anemic language, you know, of law and chain of command. Your job as a soldier is to defend the Jewish people. The jihadist's job is to try to kill the Jewish people. Our job is to try to stop him. And this soldier acted properly in that sense. Did he act properly in terms of perfect timing? I don't know, but I'm really not concerned about it, because I am much more concerned with the general atmosphere of the fight against the jihad. And I find this whole discussion to be quite distasteful. I find it to be the discussion of a group of people who are so in love with their own image of morality, instead of realizing that the most important image here is to fight bad guys and to survive. Under Putin's army or anybody else's army, this discussion would be seen as ridiculous. And that's the way I find it to be. I find it to be ridiculous. I find it to be abhorrent. I find it to be self-involved with a bunch of people who think that they are so morally high that they'll be willing to see dead Jews but still retain their moral superiority. Today on Twitter,
I am saying that morally it might be wrong to shoot an unconscious man on the sidewalk.
People can check out my picture that I sent to you on Twitter of a soldier, Israeli soldier, who had his legs blown off because he acted with too much concern for the legalities. And he's holding up a poster, and his poster says, "Don't end up like me. I stand with this soldier who acted properly and very well maybe was concerned that there was going to be." If you watch the video, there was a call out suddenly that this terrorist may have an explosive belt. He took a shot at a guy that was down. Really, I think this whole discussion is just a waste of time. It's a kind of, you know,
it's not a waste of time. And this case aside, you're right. There will be an investigation, but the point I'm getting at is we have an army. We have the Israel Defense Force that has said it is illegal that once a terrorist is neutralized, and this guy seems pretty unconscious, lying there in a pool of his own blood, once that has been reached, you are not allowed to walk up and put one in his head. I'm saying that we could discuss that, we could debate that. I probably fall on your side with whether or not that should happen, but the law is the law. If this guy, what do you think, if this guy is shown that, like it appears in the video, that he went up and said, you know what, I'm pissed off. This guy tried to kill Jews. This guy tried to stab my friend who probably has 60 to 70 stitches. I have watched people die. This guy ain't walking away from it, and walked up and put a bullet in his head. Should there be any consequence to that?
There will be consequence in that, but I just don't think it's a public issue. I think there should have been a few consequences. The consequence
it's
was,
on YouTube.
I think the consequence should have been that the first consequence should have been that the soldier should have been taken aside by his commander and reprimanded for doing such an action. Then the commander should have probably said, "But you know what, though, we really like your spirit, because you obviously have the ability to zero in on a bad guy and not let ultra-liberalism get to you, and you're able to take down bad guys and shoot them, and that's a good trait. We need you for a more advanced unit so you can go take care of more of these bad guys who surround us, want to kill us, instigate against us, create horrible movies against us, create an atmosphere of an ISIS anti-Semitism around this region. That's the issue of the day. The very fact that the Motel Wolf show today is spending so much time talking about the consequences of a soldier instead of the real reality, which is that here in Hebron, we're surrounded by at least 100,000 pro-Hamas jihadists.
We also covered Trump.
Kill every single man, woman, and child in this yeshuv. And that is the real issue that we're facing. Instead, we are spending our time with mental masturbation, falling in love with our own morality, talking about our own legality instead of talking about the incredible a murderous challenge that we are facing around us. That's the issue of the day, not the soldier who took out a jihadist who was going to be dead in 5 minutes.
All right, I feel like you're missing my point, Yishai, and I feel like
I'm not
you're
missing your point. I'm hearing
it.
Your point. I'm denying its relevancy. I think you're missing my point.
I'm saying we need to have laws. Where do you draw the line? I'm saying soldiers in the field cannot take the law into their own hands.
Yes, yes, I've heard you now the 10th time. Do you think that because I don't agree with you, it means I don't understand what you're saying? I'm telling you that it's an irrelevant issue. And if it is a relevant issue, it's relevant for a few people in command to have a conversation about how to handle such a situation. But in terms of a public discourse, all we have to say to the world is, and to our own media, a soldier shot a jihadist. Okay, he was downed. Maybe that's not the best way to behave. But whatever, that's not the big problem in this world. That's all there is to it. It's like, I actually may not think that he did the best action, but I certainly don't think it's worth a huge condemnation. And the fact is, what you also have not spoken about enough is that the nation of Israel is standing on its hind legs and saying to the government, you're not in lockstep with the way the people think. We are angry at you, Netanyahu. We're angry at you, Bogi Yaalon, for speaking this way. And in fact, other politicians like Victor Lieberman spoke against their position. And you know what? I am sure that he gained 2 seats of popularity with his statements yesterday against this unnecessary arrest and public throwing under the bus of a soldier who did what? Shot a terrorist who came to kill Jews.
I have been saying here, Yishai, into this microphone every single day for the last 6 months that no, we are killing terrorists that have come to kill Jews. We are not doing extrajudicial executions because that would be wrong. It is not wrong to kill someone that's trying to hack it to death Jews, but I think that line has to be drawn somewhere. Ultimately, we are better than them. Ultimately, and what makes us better than them is the fact that we are a moral people. And I don't think it's ultra liberal to say you don't shoot an unconscious guy who's laying on the street.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And in fact,
that's not ultra. It might be liberal. That might not be. That's not ultra liberal.
It is. It absolutely is. When you're at war, and you walk past a wounded enemy, oftentimes you shoot them to neutralize them, and that's it. And that's actually in Israeli wars. But you wouldn't know that, would you? But in actual wars, we oftentimes are told, listen, you can't deal with wounded enemies. They're combatants and they're dangerous. You take them out. That's number one. That's rules of engagement in war, and we are at war. Second thing, your whole outlook is one that I just don't share. I don't share this whole idea that the reason that we have some kind of superiority over the enemy is because we're morally better than them. That's your narrative. That's not my narrative. I don't share that outlook. That's not the way I look at things. From my point of view, my outlook is simpler, more nationalistic. It's actually less religious than yours. Yours is a religion, not, of course, the Torah religion, but the liberal religion. mine is not religious. Mine is completely. It comes from my Russian side, which is like an ethnic understanding. We've got to defend our territory. There are bad guys that want to kill us. Our standing here is not dependent on our higher morality. It's just that we have to defend ourselves. Bad guys, they got to go. Jihadists, they come at us, they're going to get killed. Frankly, one of the things that you haven't said the whole time is that maybe this video is actually a great video for the jihadists and for the ISIS. Maybe they should know that we have our own ISIS. That's what we do. It was an ISIS video from our side. Don't mess with us.
You mess with us, we'll take you out. We'll finish you off. We'll shoot you in the head because we're like that. We're not morally superior. We're not trying to be morally superior.
No, no, I agree that this serves as a good warning, and I hope people see this who want to go stab Jews.
You mess with us and you die. We will get to you first. And if you would speak that language instead of the moral betterness / sissy language that you use, then maybe we would be in better shape. I am quite disappointed in our Minister of Defense and our Prime Minister for falling right into the trap of sissiness and in the cloak of moral superiority. That's not what this is about. We got to protect the Jews of Hebron. We got to send a signal. Yes, if you come to kill Jews, you will lose your life. And if that terrorist would have gotten great medical treatment at Hadassah, then would have gone to prison, then would have learned more terrorism, then would have gone out and killed a Jew, then that whole thing wouldn't have been worth it. You know what? Have you ever thought that maybe this Jew, this soldier that shot this terrorist, saved our tax shekels, saved us from having to heal this guy instead of somebody else, and then saved a hospital bed, and then saved room in the prison, and then saved us yet another terrorist who was going to come out and kill a Jew later?
I am not upset that this guy is not in Hadassah right now.
Would have gotten up and killed a Jew 20 years from now again, okay? You would have said, thank God, and imagine that was your kid that got killed by this terrorist. Imagine that, okay? So for a second, why don't you take your hat off and say thank you for protecting us.
Let's kill him beforehand. Let's go in and kill every single male in the villages surrounding Hebron.
Every male between 13 and 40, you have proven yourself to be a would-be murderer. So I don't have to do that. He came to us. Okay, this guy was a terrorist. He's proven. He went to court and he proved that he was a terrorist by taking out a knife and trying to kill a Jew. And you know what? The justice was quick and was accurate. That's all there is to this whole story. And all this BS about our moral superiority and the laws of war and all that. That's all sissy talk of people who want to hide behind, you know, morality and all these kind of things instead of realizing who the enemy is, who the heroes are. In any other army, certainly Putin's army, we would have given this soldier a slap in the back and said, good on you, I wish I would have gotten to it first. But we're not, because we're so full of ourselves. Instead of actually protecting the Jews of Hebron and making sure that this doesn't happen, instead of sending this out as a video that says, this is what happens to ISIS-like thinkers, people who act terrorism against us, this is the ire that they will face from the IDF, you know, and don't mess with us. Instead, the whole world is laughing at us because we are jailing our own heroes. Idiotic, ridiculous, and frankly a waste of time. I think we've aired out this issue, Muttal, so I want to thank you so much.
That's my line, Yishai. I want to thank you so much.
God bless
for being on the Muttal Wolf show today, man. All right. Thanks. Yishai Fleischer is the spokesman for the Hebron community and obviously has strong opinions about this.
All right, folks. I hope you enjoyed my talk with Muttal Wolf there. And you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer show on thelandofisrael.com, broadcasting from Jerusalem to the world. Of course, my day job is to be the international spokesman for the Jewish community of Hebron, Hebron.com. And you can go to it on a website, but you got to come and visit it because Hebron is the root of the Jewish story in the land of Israel. It's the root of the Bible. It's the root of monotheistic civilization because the mothers and the fathers and the heroes of the Bible are buried in Hebron. You got to be a part of it. Come and touch it. Come and touch eternity. And of course, you can write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Follow me on Twitter. Follow me on Facebook. Most important is to follow the God of Israel as he's calling the Jewish people back home. Folks, stay tuned. Be strong. Shabbat shalom. Stay part of the story. Don't let anybody get you down. And shalom.